Hello and welcome to another edition of the Om Show. Today I'm talking to a very special guest, a friend of mine from New York, and I will let him introduce himself.
Yeah, hi everybody. My name is Abe Burmeister. I'm the founder and creative director of Outlier Clothing Company based here in New York. And you want to get into it all?
Yeah, but let's not, underscore what Outlier is, which because I've been a huge fan, though I can't fit into any clothes you make. Thanks to
We're working on that.
I'm trying to lose weight every year, and every year I get one step closer to my Outlier dream. So, you're making some changes, in my life too. But tell us more about the company and the brand for people who may not have heard about you guys.
Yeah. So what we do is try and build the future of clothing, really. We're an online-only company. We've been doing it for 9 years now. It was a very accidental project. I just couldn't find clothes that met the quality standard and the performance standard that I personally thought should exist. I thought I could just go buy them. I couldn't. So I had this moment about 10 years ago where I was like, if I can't buy these clothes, if I can't find these things, I have to learn how to make them. And rolled into the Garment District in New York, which is like an ancient technology center, the Silicon Valley of the 1900s, 1800s, really. So, late 1800s when the sewing machine was invented. 90% of the clothes in America used to come out of the Garment District. And so very few of them do now. It's much, much smaller than it used to be. But because it was such a giant, vibrant center, there's still a lot of life there. And so I just walked over to the Garment District in New York. It's a couple blocks from Times Square. So we're talking about the heart of the city. And I started asking questions, and eventually I had a pair of pants that I thought were just better. And because I knew a lot more about making websites than about making clothes, I was like, what happens if I put these things online? People buy them, maybe that'll work. And somehow it did. People started buying them, and it's not somehow, they were genuinely better than what was in the market. They did something. I was really focused on bike commuting at that time. I was trying to get healthier, but also fun riding around the city. But if you ride a bike, there's a lot of obstacles you encounter. You sweat, you might get rained on. That your clothes fall apart. I was going through a pair of jeans every couple months. And so I built something that was a genuinely better product for what I needed to do at that time. And it resonated with people. And so that was Outlier. And I also got really lucky, of course. Any business story, no matter what they tell you, there's massive amounts of hard work, brutal hard work always, but there's always some crazy luck too. So met my business partner super accidentally, because I was carrying fabric around, and my coffee shop was like, what are you doing? You're making pants? This guy over, this guy Tyler is making shirts. So that was 2008. So, and then it's just been, we've been making it up ever since.
And so both of you were making similar products, which is essentially, pants and shirts for people who wanted to ride bikes to work and not look like slobs and are not track pants?
Yeah, exactly. I was a graphic designer, and I had some clients where, some clients I could wear whatever, and some clients I had to dress up and look really sharp. And then Tyler had the same thing. He worked right across the bridge. He lived in Brooklyn, and it was a 15-minute bike ride to work for him. And the bridge is pretty high, and so it's just high enough that you always break out into a sweat. And so he would need to bring a change of clothes just for a 15-minute bike ride, and thought that this is really silly. I should be able to find a shirt that can handle a 15-minute bike ride without getting soaked and still look good and sharp. And so he was working on that. We were working with very similar technologies. We sat down. It was kind of crazy. We met in, I think it was March, and we had incorporated by June. We filed the incorporation papers. So, but we sat down and we're like, wow, we're doing exactly the same thing. Let's do this. Let's make it happen.
Now, when you talk about, doing this. There is no family history of making clothes or anything in your on your side of things, right?
No, I have one uncle or distant uncle that I'd met, but I'd never talked about clothes, who apparently had a factory at some point, in history. But other than that, there was no, it wasn't like, oh, there's a family factory here that I could walk into, or a mill, a textile mill, or anything like that. It was out of, it was a surprise to me. It was a surprise to everybody.
Wow. And so, you were in the web design business, but you are from New York, right? So you're like native New Yorker for
Yeah,
many
born and
generations.
raised. Yeah, born and raised in Manhattan, so.
Wow. And so and but you work in Brooklyn now.
Yeah, I did a switch to Brooklyn. I miss Manhattan sometimes. It's crazy now because I live and work within like a 10-minute walk, basically. So A, I don't ride bikes that much anymore because I don't need to. And B, I spent a lot of time in Brooklyn and not very much time in Manhattan anymore.
Cool.
But I still love it. It's my home. It's where I came from.
Yeah. And now you since you've been making these clothes for what you said almost 10 years now, what has changed in those 10 years, both from the perspective of your company and also from how the world perceives the clothes you guys make?
Wow. So we're bootstrapped. We started with $15,000 combined in capital, and that we had saved up, and we've never raised money. Me and Tyler own the whole thing. There's a lot of growth, like from 15,000 to where we are now, or we're at about 17 employees where we're at. I don't want to get too much into the numbers, but so that's and that's all organic, bootstrapped growth, basically. So that's a lot of change. A lot of turning around and being like, wow, wait, what happened? But the
Wow.
industry's changed a lot too, and it's something that I, as a human, as a person, I'm like super happy about. Some of the stuff that we really thought about clothing, like, has been validated, not just by people buying our stuff, but by other companies, very large companies copying what we do in, different ways, some of them more blatant than others. But there's definitely a sense of validation of the concept, like, without a question. As a business person, it's a little less fun just because, there's more competition. We were in a very blue sky space for a while. It's been a wild, wild time. So, we're at this point now where with billion-dollar corporations are basically releasing copies of outlier clothes. And they put their own spin on it, especially when they're that big and have legal departments and stuff like that. But it's been really interesting. But when we started, there was very little technology in menswear, in daily clothes. Like the stuff that you could buy, you went to a whether it was Barney's or Macy's or Forever 21, like the stuff you were going to buy is very, very similar to what you could have bought 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, in terms of what sort of what it could do, right? The fabrics were the same, the machines that were making them evolved, but and now that's different. Like, we took a lot of stuff from the outdoor industry, a lot of stuff from, like a little bit from the military, things like equestrian industry. We're always looking for different angles, workwear, different places where people are thinking about how the clothing actually functions and how to make it better. So if you walk into, say, Banana Republic, or you go and buy a pair of Dockers now or something, they're going to have offerings that incorporate a lot of things that we were doing 7, 8 years ago. Making a chino that has an incredible freedom of movement, or making pants that dry quicker and resist stains. Like, there's the chemical people call it self-cleaning, which I think is a little, in these scare quotes, it's a little excessive to say that the stuff is self-cleaning. But there's ways to treat fabric that make them a lot more resistant to stains, resistant to dirt. You put water on it and basically stuff rolls off, and that's kind of transformative. You put that on a shirt, and if you spill coffee on it, you used to have to turn around or go buy another shirt or something or live with it. Now you just kind of flick it off, right? So It's
Which
kind of.
is the great part about your journey is that you're seeing all this stuff become mainstream. Now, from your own standpoint, like when you look at the company now, the two of you were the and you had started with Tyler and you and $15,000. How many people work for you now?
It's 17 employees now.
And how, like, are you doing millions in sales, or is it
Yeah, I mean it's well into the millions. So
like
that's
tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or what?
now I'm not going to get beyond that, but
You're
we're
doing okay.
profitable. Yeah, it's we're profitable. We have to be. We're bootstrapped, right? So we're profitable. Supports 17 employees that we pay fairly. I can't say we're paying like skyrocketed amounts of money, but we pay people, fairly, and they're living in New York, and we're growing. So.
Right. Now, because of that, what I'm trying to understand is that you've done this in 9 years. You've become a big company in your mind from where you were. What did you guys do to make it happen? In a sense, I mean, a lot of people talk about bootstrapping and stuff. You guys have actually done it. Tell me a little bit of your story. Like, what were the things?
Well, first off, we actually feel a lot smaller now than when we were tiny, when we were $15,000. You don't have any sense of scale at that sort of level of naivety, which is, kind of actually really helpful for starting a company sometimes. So now we feel really small because we're like very aware that we're surrounded by giants, right? So, but beyond that, yeah, I mean it's a hard road. It's a lot of, 80-hour weeks, like don't stop. Every winter, like because of the seasonal kind of fluctuations of cash flow and stuff, we always go through these sort of traumatic periods where we're like, can we squeeze through? You know that the sales will come in the spring, or they should, but you're in the middle of the winter and nobody's buying anything, and you got to buy all the stuff for the next season. So it's a lot of like, scraping by on the edge, and being risk tolerance is really there, right? Like without having a lot of capital, you don't have that much buffer, right? But on the flip side, you fix mistakes quicker, I think. It's really easy to gloss over things with dollars when you have a lot of them, especially like at the beginning when people get a big influx of capital. You can see like they start spending money, and it's almost, if they're really disciplined business people, then they spend it right. But it's really hard not to get a kind of windfall like that and not spend it on some dumb stuff. And so, you learn, how to operate a profitable business, and that's hard.
So when you look at, like, all these companies raising, tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, and trying to grow businesses, one come, which was that Bonobos, for example, was like famously raised a shit ton of money, and there's a lot of others. When you look at them and just say, like, wow, like, that's just an incredible amount of money, and then, like, what are they doing wrong compared to what you guys are doing? Or what are
I
you
wouldn't
guys?
say they're doing anything wrong. I mean,
I mean, it's
Bonobos.
so Bonobo sold for less than what it was worth. So,
And that's not true, actually. So it's funny because from a tech valuation standpoint, Bonobos didn't sell for a huge amount of money. I think their investors walked away slightly profitable. But from a apparel standpoint, they actually sold for a very nice multiple. They've sold for about like a 2x multiple, which is very, very good for an apparel company. That the back of the envelope valuation for an apparel company is 1x revenue. So they actually did really good for themselves from those kind of standpoints. So I'm not going to say anything bad about them, except that it was never my goal to sell my company to Walmart, and I don't foresee that changing at any point in the future. But the interesting thing with watching these people raise a lot of money is we've never actually known, what we would do with that kind of money. Obviously you can spend it on a lot of things. You can hire people. Like there's lots of stuff that that you can do. You can buy tons of advertising, buy machines. But we never like saw something special that like we're like, oh, we need millions of dollars to do X, right? Like we, you know, a little extra money always helps, but it was never like, wow, we need this. Like, I think about like Apple when they first, you know, they raised venture capital money very early on, but they had a very specific reason, right? Like Steve Jobs was like, I need to an injection molded case for a computer. It's really funny, actually, when you think about it, but you know, computers came in metal cases back then that you could just whip up in a small machine shop. And he was like, no, it needs to be a appliance. It needs to fit in the home. It needs to be in the kitchen. It was their reference, right? And so they needed to cover the injection molding costs. And that's why they went and got and raised capital. We never hit that point where we're like, wow, here's a product that we could make just because, you know, but we just need more money for it. So, you know, it's interesting watching the people raise a lot of money, and we always track them and see what they do and what happens. But we never hit that point where we're like, yeah, like let's put some fuel into this flame, you know, like we're happy with the organic growth and we're happy with the level of control we have.
Right. No, but like, you know, when you look at, let's not pick names, when you look at venture backed startups and when they raise this much money, what do you think they do right and what do you think they do wrong?
Okay, I can tell you very explicitly, like, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, failure in the e-commerce space in venture, like, you know, and I think the first thing I would ever say is if you're on the venture side and you're looking to invest in one of these things, or you're running one of these companies, like, you cannot put venture capital into inventory. There's no exponential returns on inventory. Once it's in inventory, it's like this physical thing. It's sitting there. It's slow. Like, that's, you're never going to get like venture returns from a physical product that you just bought with somebody's money that they're looking for a 10x, 100x return on. So you need to put it into something that can generate that kind of return for that a VC needs, right? And so that's technology, obviously, part of it. If you have a new way to market, a new way to make things, right? Like, that kind of investment, I think, makes a lot of sense. From a venture capital standpoint. But the other thing is that there's other money out there. So like when you look at these, even, you know, some of these big ones, like, yeah, they raise some VC money like Bonobos and such, but they also raise money from investors that were looking for different types of returns. So like an apparel investor is never going to look for like a 100x, 1000x return. They're going to like, you know, 5x, 10x in 5 years or something. Even doubling it is pretty happy for some of them.
You have been in the business of technical and what I call technical clothing, and the world has changed around that. Suddenly, you know, wherever, like I'm walking around Manhattan right now, and I see like it's technical is now part of people's wardrobe, like as if like cotton was a few years ago, or wool is. Or like, you know, the usual, like the what I call the classic clothing. Like, what happened? Why did these things become part of our daily consumption so quickly and so pervasively?
I think there's a level where it's just generally better. And because there was kind of this like lull in the industry where nobody was doing it, like it was so conservative, you know, it allowed the difference between what was possible and what was available to be quite large. And so it's sort of once you open that crack up, like it was like very, very easy to be like, oh, wow, like this is a better shirt. This is a better pair of pants. And so once you experience something like a four-way stretch in a pant or, you know, you realize that your jeans don't need to wear out like that quickly and or that your clothes don't need to get dirty at the same speed, right? Like all these things, like this technology was just sort of sitting there. And again, you know, like I mentioned luck before, but that was, you know, the second wave of our company was, you know, at first we started like trying to build for bike commuting and we weren't really hardcore cyclists. So we weren't really a bike brand and we were kind of uncomfortable with that. But what we loved was all this fabric that was out there. Like we realized that there was just this technology just kind of sitting there unutilized, unused. And, we built a use case for it, and, you know, some other people were involved as well. And then once it was out there, it's kind of obvious. You're like, wow, this is better. Why would I go back? You know, so it's a classic technology story in that sense, where you're like, if you create something that genuinely performs better than what was there before, people are going to accept it. And then once they accept it, like, why would they turn around?
And so what are the things you're seeing now as you look forward into the future that we should be paying attention to as consumers and enthusiasts of technical clothing?
So the stuff that we're super excited about, it we pushed pretty hard this year, but we're going to really go a lot more into, is it's something called a warp knit weft insertion fabric. And so this is, it gets a little bit technical, but the core distinction in fabric is between a knit and a woven. It's radically different ways that they're made, and they behave differently. So it's the difference between a t-shirt and a button-up. You know, a t-shirt is knit, a button-up is woven, and they behave very differently because of these fabric differences. And with this warp knit weft insertion, you have this technology that kind of brings both worlds together. It's technically a knitting, but it behaves a lot like a woven. And we're really excited about it. And what we're using it for that's amazing is it makes just dramatically more breathable clothing that's still opaque, right? Like, you could make very, very breathable clothing the old way, but it's kind of sheer and transparent, you know, lace or a super lightweight sheer top, you know, that might end up in a woman's wear piece with, you know, layered or as something you could just see right through. We're able to make opaque pants that you can only wear in the kind of weather you wear shorts, because they're so open to the air, but closed to the eye. So it's a pretty remarkable material. As best I can tell, we're the only people in the apparel side of the business using this material at all. So we're first to market. I don't know, the market's huge, so maybe somewhere in some corner there's somebody else who can make that claim too, but so that's something we're really excited about. We call it injected linen. And that's pretty amazing. That same technology actually is crazy, because we just saw some demonstrations of them using it to make carbon fiber concrete as well, which is, it's a whole nother universe. But using like this knit carbon fiber with this weft insertion technology, you're able to make carbon concrete that's about 80% thinner. You can make concrete 80% thinner for the same strength. So it's kind of a really radical change in the construction side of things that may or may not take off. We'll see, but that's super exciting.
That's pretty cool. Now, is like, where is this innovation coming from? Like, is it coming from the US? Is it like people in China trying to invent new things? Is it coming from Europe? Like, I've always been fascinated by all this innovation in fabrics and technical fabrics and stuff. And I have like literally no idea where all this is coming from. So educate me on that.
It's global. It's super global. A lot, the Europeans are definitely heavily into it. They're very heavily on the machine side. It's a massive global industry. So like, you know, this warp knit weft insertion technology I'm talking about, the company that makes the machines is German, but the company that we work with that developed like an apparel grade fabric that we could work with is based in Japan, right? So you're having like innovation, like just flying around the world essentially. So, the Germans are super at it. The Italians are super at it. The America definitely is pushing certain things super hard. America's really good with cotton because there's a huge cotton industry. So like, cotton gets lots and lots of sort of attention in America. But America's the second largest fabric maker in the world. Nobody knows it because it doesn't really go into apparel. It goes into like the kind of fabrics that cover farms and, you know, make mile-long conveyor belts and things like that, or military. So Japan, super innovative. There's lots of chemical stuff coming out of Japan, like new fibers. And then China, there's interesting stuff happening in China too. Like they've traditionally been focused on the more production, cheaper side. But that's changing very, very rapidly. And so we've seen some really innovative stuff come out of sort of these Chinese-European partnerships, where it might be like a European scientist paired with a Chinese production facility. And the funding is coming from who knows where, probably from both parts of the world. And so, you know, it's pretty much inevitable that at this point China is going to be one of the main innovators within the very, very short time period.
Right. So there has been one material I've been extremely fascinated by, the stuff you use for your bags and your backpacks. Yeah. So tell me more about that.
Yeah, so Dyneema is the world's strongest fiber, right? So there's actually this crazy British movie from the 50s called The Man in the White Suit. Might be missing a word or two in there, but and it's about basically this guy who invents Dyneema. It's a really good movie, actually. But they didn't call it, Dyneema didn't exist, but it's a super strong white fiber. They use it to tie up like Panamax boats, right? Like the biggest boats in the world. This stuff is 15 times stronger than steel and it floats on water. So if you want to tie that boat up and anchor it, like use Dyneema. The stuff we use is actually a Dyneema composite. So it's Dyneema combined with a few other materials. And it was developed in the 90s to win the America's Cup. They wanted to make better sails that they could, you know, and there's a lot of technology that goes into just winning the America's Cup. And this fabric came out of it. They built a better sail out of it. Lighter, stronger, stiffer. And then what happened is the company that made it, you know, it stayed in the sailing world for a decade or so, maybe two almost. And the company that made it eventually sold the sailing, the rights to make sails out of it to a big sail company. But they kept the rights to make the material for any other use. And so they realized that it could be used in bags. And so we stumbled upon them, I guess it was like 7 or 8 years ago, right? When they were kind of starting this process and nobody was using it except for these really, really obscure hiking, ultralight kind of hiking companies. And it's a super intriguing material. It's incredibly light. It's quite strong. You know, because it's so light, it's comparable to most bag fabrics in durability. It's not like more durable. If you use lots of Dyneema, you can make an indestructible bag. And it's very stable. It takes on character. So we were really fascinated by it. And it took us a long time to be able to work with it because it requires constructions a little. It's not like totally different. It's not like you have to build a whole new process for making it. But every piece, when you cut it, when you sew it, when you want to tape it, you know, seal the seams, every little process there, like it behaves differently. And so it took finding the right partner and really learning the ins and outs of this material to get it there. But it's fascinating. It makes these just really, really light and stable bags that you can kind of like pack up into nothing, and then they feel like nothing when they're empty. And then you fill them, they actually carry quite well.
Man, I'm obsessed with those things. Like, you know, I know you guys make them. I have another friend. His company SDR Traveler has
Jan.
He's nuts about it. So I have one of his duffel bags, and I kind of like carry it around whenever I travel into the cold places I go to. So this is something like what fascinates me about all these materials is lack of weight and, you know, adaptability and the strength, and I just think the man-made, you know, materials are just coming into their own. I'm pretty sure there is more out there which will have an influence.
Oh, definitely. We're actually, one of the things that we're really fascinated about is actually when the natural and the man-made materials come together. So we're actually doing denim. We did it. We called it End of World Denim as an experiment this spring, where we're using Dyneema fibers, but also cotton, right? So you're kind of trying to get the best of both worlds. And it's really interesting because you can, you know, the early uses of synthetics, like the basic polyesters and nylons that you're familiar with are not very sophisticated, right? Like when you look at them under a microscope, you're talking about very, very simple fiber constructions. Whereas, a cotton is a plant, it's evolved, like it has much more going on in there. And then the protein-based fibers are like the wools and the silks are vastly more complicated. Like when you look at their properties and what's going on, like there's just a lot going on in there. And so we're at this point with the synthetics where people are starting to use them in much more sophisticated ways rather than just sort of the straightforward, like, we're going to take this plastic, this nylon plastic, this polyamide, and just stretch it out until it's a yarn, you know, like that's your basic nylon and it's strong, but it, you know, it's not that exciting beyond that. But when you start working with it and like, you know, treating it and trying to figure out, you know, what happens when you shoot hot air at it and like sort of a rhythmic pattern of what happens when you chop it up into little pieces and then twist it back together, you end up with what's much more sophisticated materials that do a lot more in the end of the day. And they wear nicer, they feel nicer. Like it's a fascinating world. So like another example is we're looking at a lot of blends of nylon and wool, where the nylon is chopped up into little pieces and then twisted together with the wool. And you end up creating something that just kind of amplifies like the good characteristics of wool, but is a lot stronger and like kind of takes some of the bad characteristics out. So it's, and there's lots of examples like that.
Do you feel that like if because of the climate change and all the other things which are happening around us, that we might actually have to go in the direction of technical clothing because cotton and other fabrics are becoming more difficult to grow and the water is, you know, getting increasingly a precious commodity?
Wow, yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. But yeah, I mean, traditional cotton and even organic cotton tends to use more water. So yeah, that's a hard one. And cotton's also grown where food crops are grown. So cotton's a really tough one when you look at it from an environmental perspective. Something like wool is sort of the opposite. Like, you know, there's certain framings where you can look at wool and be like, wow, this uses so much land. It's really intensive, but it's land that almost nothing else like usable works on, right? These sheep will graze on the side of a mountain and you can't really turn it into cropland or harvest anything off of it. So you get a very efficient transformation of the sun's energy into this beautiful fiber just by these sheep, you know, kind of hanging out on the side of a mountain, eating some grass, living their lives. But yeah, cotton could hit a crisis. There's no question about it. It's grown in the same sort of soil that you can grow food and it uses a lot of water. And when you take the chemicals away, the water use tends to increase. There are people working on kind of rain-fed cotton, so like you can set up an entire cotton system that doesn't require any irrigation, but you know where you can do that is limited, and how far they can take it and how much it can scale is in question. So I wouldn't make a prediction there, but it's definitely a threat. Like you can definitely see scenarios where cotton's just a precious commodity all of a sudden, and your jeans cost 10 times as much.
Well, I definitely think about, you know, all these things, and I'm looking at this and it's like, yep, I think culturally we need to kind of put our, behaviors away from massive consumption to, you know, buying fewer things but which lasts longer, because I don't think our planet can keep supporting, you know, this kind of excessive growth. You know, this fast fashion may be interesting and nice, but in the end, the cost of fast fashion like, you know, is being borne by the planet. Not, you know, we may pay less, but it's still coming out of our own pockets. We just don't know it yet.
Oh,
And
yeah.
you know, if I could put my entire wardrobe in basically in a duffel and look good and be elegant and, you know, and yet be comfortable, you know, to me that is essentially the ideal. Like, that would be my utopia. Like, I don't have to, you know, I'm happy to spend $1,000 on a pair of pants as long as I don't have to buy another one for a couple of years, you know.
All right. Well, so we're you know, we make that. We got to get your size going. We're trying to expand our size offering slowly. Like, you know, the sizing is basically a bell curve. So it's mathematically, like, we push it when we can. So yeah, we're gonna help you out there, because
yeah,
that's the clothing we make.
So for you, like, when you look at all these new fabrics and new materials, like, how do you find about them? Do you go, like, study these, or people come to you, or, like, what's your process? Or do you actually, or have you invented some of your own materials? And
yeah, we're developing quite a few materials now, which is amazing. That's a new thing over the last few years. But yeah, we hunt. It's fun. I'm actually flying to Paris tomorrow to go to European fabric show called Premier Vision. And so that's actually, like, more of the high fashion side of stuff. And so when we go to a show like that, we're looking for, like, the things that might have a technical edge in that context. And then we'll also go out to, like, the outdoor industry and, like, look through what their supply chains. And, you know, when we go there, it's, like, the opposite. We're looking for, like, the stuff, like, that those vendors might make that actually, like, looks and feels the way that it needs to operate in an urban context. And then we go to deeper stuff where, like, it's much more technical, where there are people making industrial fabrics or fabrics. You know, we once stumbled across a fabric that was really fascinating. We turned to the rep and we're like, what is this used for? And he was like, well, yeah, they use it to make these suits for cleaning out the inside of nuclear power plants, right? So we didn't actually end up using it, but it was fascinating. You know, like, there's these edge cases where the needs get really powerful, and so you build these really specific and fascinating fabrics. So we're always just kind of hunting, and there's thousands and thousands of them. So it's a big filtering process. It's like trying to figure out how it works, and then trying to figure out what makes it special, and then, you know, it's a lot of just digging, traveling, looking, reading. And we look in history books too, right? We're not just purely about, like, the newest stuff, right? We actually use some of the world's oldest fibers too, and sometimes in the right use case, they're actually better. So, you know, it's hot and humid here in New York right now, and what I would recommend right now is something called Rami, which is possibly the world's oldest fiber. It's similar to linen, but it comes through Southeast Asia, and it just, it's amazing in the humidity. It sucks the moisture away from your body, and, like, you're dry and the area around you is really super humid, but you're right close to your body, you're actually dry and comfortable and cool. And, you know, there's no advanced technology in there at all. There actually is some technology involved in making it knittable, right? Like, natural fibers don't just, like, you know, t-shirts don't grow on the cotton plant. You gotta take the cotton and do huge amounts of processing to make it wearable. And same with Rami. Rami is very hard to process, actually. But, you know, the right stuff is, you gotta look at all the angles and figure it out and see what can be put together. And
so, yeah, and so tell me more about, you know, what are the things or the brands which you think are doing interesting work and we should be keeping an eye on them? I mean, of course, Outlier is at the forefront of a lot of these things, but, you know, who's making great t-shirts? Who's making other great clothing which could be part of the, and, you know, I'm talking about independent brands, not the big giants.
We don't discriminate in that kind of way. Like, there's people that do really interesting stuff and there's people that don't, you know? So, you know, there's some obvious stuff that we get compared with, like the, you know, Arc'teryx in the outdoor space. They're like the master craftsmen. They still own one of their own factories. They use a lot of other factories too, but they have their own factory, and they have a level of expertise where they can do things with certain types of fabrics like that nobody else can do. So, you know, they're always doing amazing stuff. And, you know, Stone Island is another one that we look at a lot, like, you know, it's an Italian outerwear company that's built, like, you know, very, very involved processes to work with technical stuff, but also a lot of very interesting visual techniques. They do all their own dyeing, and really kind of push on a sort of like technical aesthetic level, in fascinating ways. You know, there's stuff in the women's wear space that I think is actually more impressive technically than the men's stuff, like something like Spanx, you know, like that stuff's all patented to like crazy, right? That's technical advancement right there. Victoria's Secret actually does like lots and lots of technical development. Nobody ever knows it. And then there's, you know, I love, there's a couture designer, Iris Van Herpen, who does just like stunning, you know, it's art, right? It's couture, it's fashion, but just amazing stuff working with new technologies, you know, working with scientists at MIT to develop ways to 3D print garments in wild, like sort of computer generated patterns, and working with new materials and new techniques. And then in terms of basics, you know, the best cotton tee. I mean, I'm a big fan of Dave's Army Navy in New York City. That's the first place I would go.
Yeah, man, those places are vanishing fast these days. Kind of sucks.
Yeah, there's still brands that, you know, like the Carhartts and stuff. Like we have huge amounts of respect for those companies that are like kind of in that space where performance still matters, but price matters a lot too, and they're able to generate like really high value clothing. Stuff that's just really durable and works, right? It does what you need to do, and it's not going to break.
Yeah. Cool. Well, before we go, I have to ask you, what's your advice to other people who are, let's say, thinking about starting a company in let's say, clothing company, or trying to, you know, just grow as bootstrap businesses? What are the things you think they should be doing, or they, you know, are paying attention to?
I mean, the first thing you have to know why you want to be bootstrapped. You know, I'm very happy that we've taken that path, and it, the reason that we did it is really control. You know, we thought that, like, to make the clothing that we want to make, like, part of the reason other people weren't doing it because they were getting too much pressure from their investors. And that's why sort of some of the materials that we started working with and whatnot weren't available. So we made a very conscious choice that we're going to try not to get capital, just to keep that level of control. But on the flip side, if your company, like, you know, needs capital, it's going to need capital. So it's not about being, you can't be too stubborn about these things. But in terms of if you want to do it and you're bootstrapped, you know, you got to be profitable. There has to be more money coming in at the end than is going out, and it's going to go right back out. Like, it won't feel like you're profitable because it's all going back into inventory and salary and different pieces, you know, infrastructure. But you gotta focus on that and make sure that there's enough money in the bank. And so everything you make has to sell, essentially. You gotta figure out how to, you don't want to be sitting on inventory. Inventory's death. That's kind of like one of the hardest things. A clothing company need enough inventory that people can buy stuff. But if you have too much, you're basically going to go out of business because, you know, all your money is sitting in a very illiquid asset. And I don't know. It's trying to figure out how much you can do in a day while still getting enough sleep to stay alive.
Well, I think you've done a great job of staying alive and making great clothes, and hope to speak to you soon again and keep doing what you're doing.
All right, I appreciate it.
I aspire to be in your clothes one day.
No, we're gonna make it happen. I guarantee it. We're gonna figure out how this will happen.
Okay, thanks, brother, and thank you again for your time. Have a great trip to Paris.
All right, and yeah, enjoy New York.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.